Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there. This is Steve Behrman, and welcome to Wiki Politiki. This is our first show of the new year, and once again, in the hopes that this new year will bring something truly new, maybe some new news to replace the old news. And the way we have new news is by shifting our focus of attention from the content to the context, because in this information age, there's plenty of content, nothing but content. We also have knowledge as our mental way of organizing and giving meaning to that content. However, there's something else we need to cultivate, something that is more rare and so much more important, wisdom. We have information, we have technology, we have knowledge, and yet without wisdom, we will likely misuse all of that technology, all of that information for domination and possibly destruction. Albert Einstein said that the field is the sole governing power over the particle. So we can think of those particles as the material world. And we can think of the field as the beliefs and perceptions and thoughts that organize how we organize our reality. So to restate the purpose of Wiki Politiki Radio, it's to bring a new context to our political affairs so that we use wisdom, which is the place where the heart and mind are in accord, to organize the content. Today our guest is Joe Simonetta, and he's going to help us do that. He'll be talking about his intriguing book, Seven Words That Can Change the World. Now, I'm not going to tell you what those seven words are. Joe will. But I will reassure you that they're not the seven words that George Carlin said we can't say on radio. We'll be able to say these words. Now, Joe Simonetta has had a very varied background. He's been an architect. He's been a congressional candidate. He was a student at Harvard Divinity School. His work and experience that has provided him with insights that I hope will incite you, the listener, to greater awareness and so on. This really is the way to launch the new year and spark an evolutionary uprising. Joe's book is a context. It gives us a context for how to be in the world in these evolutionary times so that we thrive as individuals and as a species. Welcome, Joe.
Hey, thanks, Steve. It's great to be on your program, and thanks to our mutual friend, Jeff Huttner, for making the connection.
Yes, Jeff Huttner has been involved in paradigm shifting ever since I've met him, and he's a phenomenal networker. And when I read your work, I said, this is something that my listeners need to be exposed to. So this is the idea that there are seven words that can change the world is a pretty bold idea. So before we get to those seven words, what was it that sparked this to come up in you? What was the question or puzzle that you were looking to solve in your life or the world?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's like for so many of us, it's in my DNA. It's just who I am. I've had this concern for so many decades. You know, I'm going to be 75 years old this year, so I've been concerned about the state of the world for a long, long time. If I think back about maybe some triggering events to answer your question, I remember when I was pretty young and I was at home in my parents' home and I was watching television and I saw another example of suffering. And I was just outraged that the suffering occurs. It really, really bothered me. And I was pretty young. And I remember standing in front of the television and saying, with great intensity, I am going to do something about this. You know, and many, many decades later, I ended up writing this book, which is about my seventh book. But the interesting thing about that is, you know, I wasn't the son of a senator or in an affluent family. It was lower middle class. My father was had an eighth grade education. My mother was 12th grade. My father was an immigrant, had to go to work. He had three sons. I was the middle son. But they were great parents and great examples. My older brother went to the United States Military Academy at West Point. My younger brother did an MBA at Vanderbilt and recently retired as the vice president with Pepsi. And I've gone and done a lot of things and have several degrees. So I give a lot of credit to my parents for the direction. The other thing that comes to my mind in terms of your question is when I was about 40 living in L.A. and working in architecture, I remember distinctly that it occurred to me that we, humanity, have created a destructive and unsustainable momentum that must be arrested and reversed if we're going to sustain humanity and advance our civilization. And from that awareness, I was just driven even more to try to do something. And then I went on and on and did a lot of different things.
You know, it's interesting that your career, you started as an architect and then you ended up at Harvard Divinity School. What sparked the registering at Harvard Divinity School, and what was that experience like for you?
Well, I didn't start as an architect. I started studying architecture when I was 32 years old, actually. Out of undergraduate school, which was Penn State, I was a military officer for a couple of years, and then I programmed computers for the Bethlehem Steel Corporation a long time ago. That was in the 60s. And then after that, I was in sports. I was in tennis. I had played varsity tennis and soccer for Penn State. I was in sports for some years, and I started a company designing and manufacturing ladies' tennis clothing. Then I got out of that, sold that company, went to L.A., and I started studying architecture at SC, University of Southern California, transferred to the University of Colorado, and got a master's degree at the University of Colorado, did very well in architecture, worked a little bit in Colorado. Then I worked in Los Angeles for several years in architecture. And when I was about 40, I made a decision. I had an opportunity to get associated with a very good firm in Westwood right there by UCLA. And I said, no, I'm going to do something. I was going to go to Washington, but instead I ended up going back to Florida, and I wrote my first book, which was called The Heroes Are Us, A Call to Rescue Our World. And I ran for Congress in Pennsylvania from Pennsylvania's 15th Congressional District, 17-month campaign, 12 hours a day. I was a complete unknown. I hadn't lived there for 15 years. I won the Democratic Party nomination. I lost in the general election to a fifth term incumbent. And after that, I went to New Zealand and I lived in a small hut. You didn't really know this. I mean, we never talked about it. I lived like a monk, 10 feet by 12 feet were the dimensions of the hut. I built all the furniture by hand at night. I wrote another book called Russell, Alexander, and John, The Story of Personal and Planetary Change. I had no electricity. I only had candlelight and kerosene light. And yeah, that was a great experience. And when I came back, I worked in sports again in Florida and started a nonprofit, environmental nonprofit organization in Sarasota, Florida. And I decided I wanted to study more. And that's when I went to Yale and Harvard Divinity School, which was 1990-91, I think it was. And a year at Yale Divinity School, then I transferred to Harvard and did a couple years at Harvard and got a master in Divinity at Harvard. I think you wanted to know what it was that I discovered at these divinity schools.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, I want to reflect on what you just said, because like so many people that I interview, you had this as a child. As a child, you saw something that was a disconnect in the world, and you were looking for your own way to make a difference. That's one of the reasons why I do what I do, why I interview people, is so that people can get a reflection on how these individual journeys end up contributing to the whole picture. So I can see where you how you got to somehow that's something that happened in running for Congress and living in a hut and doing all these other things sparked you to go to divinity school. What was it? It seems like you're from what I've read of your work, you're not a religious person and maybe you don't even believe in God. What was it about divinity school that attracted you?
Well, I did some research on various schools, and I decided to go to Yale. I found out that you can do a program of your own design at Yale, and I went to Yale and Harvard essentially to study ethics, to study issues associated with global environmental problems and study world belief systems in general. You know, I was 50 years old the year I graduated from Harvard. You know, as such, I remained objective in my study and analysis of world religions. I studied all the world religions. They're all interesting and rich in history and rituals, yet they remain human constructs formed thousands of years ago in the infancy of our intelligence by people like you and me. The historical context and the ancient mindsets that produce these belief systems is abundantly evident. They're all part of our very early efforts to understand and cope with the withering and unrelenting demands of life. Now, as such, they should be treated like all other institutions that we've created. Now, ancient and antiquated, they should be studied as history, not adopted as belief systems. No disrespect or disparagement is meant by that. I respect the good efforts of all those who have preceded us honorably, but we're no different than they in our quest for life's ultimate answers. But as Gandhi once said, religious ideas are subject to the same laws of evolution that govern everything else in the universe. In other words, there comes a time to let go of dated ideas and advance as life demands. The Buddha actually said something similarly 2,600 years ago. Brilliant statement. He said, to insist on a spiritual practice that served us in the past is to carry the raft on our back after we've crossed the river. And for myself, having crossed the river, it was time to examine the concept of sacredness, and basically that's what I did.
So you wrote a thesis, or this became your first book, right? Or one of your books while you were at Divinity School.
It was actually the forerunner. Seven Words That Can Change the World. Yeah, but in terms of your question about gods and not necessarily believing in gods. If you'd like, I can address that.
Yeah, I'm always interested in how people look at exactly what you talked about, which is how we actually evolve from a more primitive religious understanding to something that is more cosmological. So go ahead, tell us.
First, let me say that at Harvard, aside from divinity school, I also studied cosmology, you know, the origin and structure of the universe, as I felt that was a key component. And I was studying these belief systems, by the way, because after having done so many things in my life, I realized that our behavior is rooted in our belief systems. So I wanted to study belief systems. So I studied cosmology, the origin and structure of the universe, and I also asked famed evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson if I could sit in on his evolutionary biology class, which I did, and that was another critical a piece of the puzzle to understand that, as you know, dealing with your co-writer about biology and the biological influence. But as for religion, one finds that religion is an untested collection of dogmatic principles, typically from supernatural sources and something referred to as divine revelation. It's a phenomenon that came along when priests and priestesses invented themselves, which they continue to do today. You know, humorist Will Rogers once said, we sow wild oats 6 days a week. In other words, we get a little crazy 6 days a week. And the seventh, we pray to our religion for crop failure.
Yeah, you know, it's That's very good.
Yeah, we sow wild oats 6 days a week, the seventh, we pray to our religion for crop dealer. It begs the question, though, like, what is religion? Yeah, what is religion? Now, religion can be defined in a couple of ways. It can be defined as a belief in and worship of a God, which raises questions. What and who's God or goddess? The conflicts over definitions of gods and goddesses, the distraction and diversion of our attention to all these different gods. But religion, and this is really critical to understand, religion can be defined as a belief system that has to do with the cause, purpose, and nature of life in the universe. And we think to ourselves, yeah, that makes sense, cause, purpose, and nature of life in the universe. That's what people have been doing for thousands of years. People profoundly ignorant of our world as the way we understand it today attempted to define the cause, purpose, nature of life in the universe. They often claiming divine revelation for their inspiration, the knowledge and authority, they created gods. They created creation stories. They created texts, and they created fiercely tribal religions with rules, rituals, costumes, and music. It's essential to understand that this occurred thousands of years before the scientific revolution and the age of reason, when in the 16th to 18th centuries, mathematics, chemistry, physics, astronomy, biology, and anatomy emerged and set forth a whole range of ideas based on reason as the source of authority and legitimacy. Religious creeds, doctrine, and dogma were questioned, and religious authority was challenged for the first time, all for very good reasons. Today...
We got to take a break right now. We'll be back to hear more about the evolution, how religion, religious ideas can evolve. Wiki Politiki, we'll be right back.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma, and wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hello, this is Steve Behrman. We're back on WikiPolitiki with our guest, Joe Simonetta. He is the author of Seven Words That Can Change the World. And we were talking about how so many of these religious systems that people subscribe to simply have not integrated the information that has come our way over the last several hundred years about what is really so about the universe. And so consequently, there are people who believe that the Earth is just 6,000 years old totally discount all of the scientific evidence that it's way, way, way older than that. So before we get to those seven words, Joe, why don't you complete your ideas about where religion has taken us so far and how we can pick up from there?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. What I was saying is today we don't need divine revelation to understand the cause, purpose, and nature of life in the universe. The Big Bang theory is the generally accepted theory for the cause of the universe. The purpose of the universe, we don't have a clue what the purpose of the universe is. All of the planets, the stars, and the galaxies that we can see only represent 4% of the universe. When we look up in the sky on a particularly clear and starry night, we think we're looking at the universe, but in fact, we're looking at about 2,500 stars of the 200 to 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which is one of trillions of galaxies. And the universe is expanding at a speed in excess of 186,000 miles a second, or in excess of a billion miles an hour. We don't have a clue what the purpose of all that is. The nature of the universe, however, is another matter. It's here where the enigma unravels. It's here where a non-religious understanding of sacredness emerges.
Good. Let's keep going with that. That sounds like exactly where we want to get to. How all of this gets integrated.
One of the things we wanted to talk about was the fact that we advance technologically easily, but not socially, politically, or intellectually. We continue to destroy each other and the environment. And the question is, mm-hmm. Why is that? We don't drive around in vehicles that are thousands of years old. We don't see chariots running down the streets. Yet we cling to belief systems that are literally thousands of years old, products of the infancy of our intelligence. As a consequence, many people live in a world of fiction and fantasy. We don't understand our reality and the behavioral demands of our reality. Instead of seeing the security that's found in our oneness and our togetherness, we create all kinds of divisions, all kinds of tribes, nation state tribes, political party tribes, religious tribes, corporate tribes, and on and on. The result is we're not more secure, but we're less secure. We've created a destructive and unsustainable momentum that must be arrested and reversed if we're going to sustain humanity and advance our civilization. We need a non-religious understanding of what's sacred in our world. And this requires entering into a complete new understanding of our reality. The window of opportunity to make the necessary and monumental shift in our thinking is small compared to the large obstacles in our current belief systems that must be dissolved. Yet we must do this if we and all the life forms on this jewel of a planet are going to survive.
So that really is certainly true. That what you're suggesting is that we have learned as much as we could learn about technology to create these amazing inventions, and yet our social inventions are still limited by the kinds of ways that we have habitually learned to relate to one another, and also hampered by many of the religious structures. And yet you said earlier, you quoted Buddha 2,600 years ago, who seemed to have have it exactly right. And he was talking about in 2,600 years ago, he was talking about living from beliefs in the past. So This has obviously been an ongoing condition for quite a while.
It has, and you know, of course, change is incremental, but we're at a time when change is essential. And philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer once said, "All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted as being self-evident." Now, such a truth has emerged in our lifetime. It informs us that we exist as a tiny fragment of an immensely larger interlocking whole in which all the parts are interconnected and depend upon each other for survival. Let me repeat that, if I can.
Yeah, please, please do.
A truth has emerged in our lifetime that informs us that we exist as a tiny fragment of an immensely larger interlocking whole in which all the parts are interconnected and depend upon each other for survival. Simply put, everything's connected to everything else. We exist not separately, but in communion with all other living things. Life's an interrelated, interdependent phenomenon. Everything's in relationship. That's the nature of the universe. That's the nature of life. So you might reasonably ask or say, so what? Everything's in relationship. So what? You know, what's the practical value of that? The practical value lies in the realization that there are several relationships that are foundational. I call these the foundational relationships of life. These are three relationships out of which all the relationships follow. First is our relationship with ourself. The second is our relationship with others. And the third is our relationship with the environment. If we took one word to describe what optimizes each of these relationships is, relationship with self is about health. Relationships with others is about kindness. Relationship with the environment is about respect. Health, kindness, and respect. The quality of our lives reflect the quality of these relationships. This is a sacred construct that exists as an integral part of reality. This is not a human construct. Why would I say such a thing? It's a sacred construct. It's not a human construct. It's because these relationships represent that in life which, at our peril, we cannot violate, damage, dishonor, or destroy. If we do, we suffer. That's simply the way life works. It's not contrived or fiction. It's not arbitrary or subject to dismissal, nor is it any way negotiable. How we take care of ourselves, each other, and the environment determines not only the quality of our lives, but whether we live or die. These relationships are sacred. They're the wellsprings of life. We emerge from these relationships. We're sustained by them. We are surrounded by the very sacredness that historically we've sought from afar.
That's really very interesting. So what you're saying is that we don't need to have anything to we can find ways of living our lives that are exceedingly practical, that relate to the nature of what we do know absolutely about how life works, and we don't need the blessings or imprimatur of an off planet God. And use these three extraordinary words: health, kindness, and respect. Say more about that and how that would play into a context for living our lives.
Let me see where to begin with this. The point is there's a certain way that we have to behave. If we, it's like Lao Tzu wrote 2,600 years ago in the Tao Te Ching, that he in fact was the writer. We really don't know who were the writers of these books. There's a way of life. If you honor the way of life, we prosper. If we violate the way of life, we suffer needlessly. We really have no choice.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about the health, kindness, and respect how we treat ourselves, how we treat other people, and how we treat the world around us. You know, if you look at the teachings of Jesus, you have love thy neighbor, love thyself, and love God as a prescription, you know, perhaps three suggestions that override the Ten Commandments. And if you substitute for God, if you substitute life and the web of life, then it's basically having, you know, a great spiritual teacher, as, you know, Buddha, Jesus, etc., all really telling people the same thing, that these rules that human beings would like to believe have been given by some infinite being outside of them, those rules have been given basically as a like the law of gravity, as something that guides how we have to be. Why haven't people been listening to, you know, Buddha said it 2,600 years ago, Jesus said it 2,000 years ago? Why hasn't it taken hold as a way of being?
Let me add, before we get to that, let me just tag on to it. You know, there's something I refer to as the reverse side of the golden rule,
yeah,
which relates to this. You know, life broadcasts a riveting truth, which is no escape. I call it the reverse side of the golden rule, where the golden rule suggests that we do to others as others do to us. The reverse side of the golden rule does not suggest anything, but warns that what we do to others, we do to ourselves. In an interconnected world, all exploitation and oppression inevitably returns to its source. This is a reality that we must understand, and from this understanding, make the critical mind shift required of us if we're going to sustain humanity and advance our civilization. This mind shift is to understand clearly, unequivocally, that what we do to others, we do to ourselves. Now, this is evident in the three foundational relationships of life. We take our relationship with the environment. If we damage and destroy the environment, we damage and destroy ourselves. Take our relationships with each other. If we mistreat and or are unkind to others, our actions return to haunt us or torment us in one form or another over time. Take our relationships with ourselves. If we abuse ourselves or health in any one of countless ways, sooner or later we suffer the consequences. When all of this becomes evident and acted upon, our belief system and our behavior becomes fused. Our belief system is not just something for one day of the week or a particular time of the day when we pray or bow to this or that God, or to be celebrated in special places only. Our belief system becomes our lifestyle, and our lifestyle becomes aligned with the larger reality in which we exist, which is the reality that Lao Tzu was probably writing about.
You know, that's really interesting. That also Bruce Lipton, as a cellular biologist who has also delved into both Newtonian physics and quantum physics, in a certain regard, we're still living, we're still doing our politics and our interactivity with one another as if we lived in a Newtonian universe of simply actions and opposite reactions. And that scientific understanding of several hundred years ago has now been superseded by the understanding that you just pointed out, that everything is in relation. So it's not just our spiritual beliefs that have to be upgraded. It's also our understandings of what science is teaching us about that interrelationship, and the fact that it's not really survival of the fittest. We're living like it's survival of the fittest, but really it's thrival of the fittingest. It's we thrive inside the web of life, and if you're in harmony, in coherence with that, then things move a lot better. And if you're not, then that's where the suffering takes place. So I think that was the thing that most appealed to me about your book, is that you're talking about the most practical evidence of how we are to live in these in what Swami Beyondananda would call a shrinking world that could use a good shrink. So say more about how is it now? What makes it different now that people might take Buddhist coaching, they might take Jesus is coaching, and they might actually take the coaching of the golden rule and through science understand the reverse golden rule, which incidentally Jesus said, what you do to me, what you do to the least of us, you do to me. That was his way of saying it. So we're at a point, we're going to take a break shortly, but when we come back for the last 20 minutes of the show, I'd really like to explore why is now different, what those seven words might be, and how do we begin to reorganize our own hearts and minds and then society to live that way. I know that's a lot of that's a big mouthful. We've got about 2 minutes before the break. Why don't we just begin?
Let me say this in a minute. I think part of the shift of thinking is that often the question is asked, what's the purpose? What's the meaning of life? That's the wrong question. The question should be, what are the responsibilities of life? And the answer is pretty simply, take the word apart, responsibility, make two words of it. Responsibility. It's our ability to respond to life's challenges and stimuli to optimize and sustain our relationships with our own health, with other people and other nation states, and with our environment, our ecological system, and our biosphere. Those are the responsibilities of life. It's again, it's a part of a shift that it's actually occurring. You know, it's incremental and maybe not so obvious, but more and more people are thinking along these lines.
Yeah, and I think you actually used the idea that we are all really part of this one body politic, and so our responsibilities inside the context of being part of this one body, then very clearly, the cells need to cooperate with one another. We'll be back after this break with Joe Simonetta and find out the seven words that could change the world.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toast from a shelter in 2011. I love Toast because she's a lazy diva. Toast does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Bierman back with Joe Simonetta. Before we get back into the interview, some little logistics. If you want to contact us at WikiPolitiki, the best way is to go to my website, wakeuplaughing.com, and send us a message at info@wakeuplaughing.com. If you have suggestions for guests, comments on the shows, you want to become a member, you want to become a sponsor, that would be the way to do it. Also, our friend Joe here, he can be reached at Joe Simonetta, that's S-I-M-O-N-E-T-T-A, @gmail.com. JoeSimonetta@gmail.com, and he is available as a speaker and presenter on this topic. So welcome back, Joe, for the last 15 or so minutes of our show. Let's go right into our how our species gets to grow up. How do we grow up? How do we become the species that actually listens to the great spiritual teachers and the template that science is providing for us?
Okay, thanks, Steve. Let me first begin by talking just briefly about sacredness, a non-religious understanding of sacredness, and then the three rules, the seven words, and then to your question about transformation, how we make the change. Can we do it like that?
Sure, absolutely.
Let's begin with sacredness. Sacredness is not a complex, esoteric, or difficult thing to understand. It's found in real-life relationships, here and now, you know, not out there somewhere. It's not about a supreme being. It's about a way of being. The focus of our beliefs must shift from what was imagined to exist and be sacred in some heavenly realm to what does exist and is sacred here and now. It's time to find our comfort not in the worship of distant mythological gods, but in real-life relationships with each other, our environment, and our own individuality. These commandments are not issued by a god, but by the undeniable reality of our existence. Now, certainly the fictional gods of our historical religions would approve of this shift of emphasis, but when we take care of ourselves and each other and our environment, we're living a sacred life. One would think if there exists anything benevolent in dimensions beyond our perception, called a God, a creator, supreme being, universal intelligence, divine consciousness, or what have you, that it, she, him, or them would cheer us wildly if the focus of our lives was on health for ourselves, kindness towards each other, and respect for our environment. You know, for what more could any God of any belief system anywhere ask of us? Now, as far as the seven words, three rules, seven words, now most of us are familiar with the Ten Commandments that appear in Exodus, the second book of the Bible written about 3,300 years ago. And what do these Ten Commandments say? The first four are issues having to do with a God, and the Sabbath, and the next six are about behavior. We're told to honor our parents and not murder, steal, lie, commit adultery, or covet. It seems to me, and I think you'd agree, that we've learned a few things in the last 3,300 years. And maybe instead of the Ten Commandments, we require three simple rules for living that say and do more than the Ten Commandments. Three rules, seven words. When we follow them, we eliminate the majority of problems and suffering in the world, problems the Ten Commandments don't address. And none of these rules appear in the Ten Commandments. The first is be healthy. Each one of us is like a cell, as Steve said. Each one of us is like a cell in the body of humanity. The health of all of us taken together determines the health of humanity and the health of our civilization. These bodies and minds that we occupy are the most exquisite. They may be the most exquisite machine on the planet. The abuse to which we subject them, we wouldn't dream of doing to our material possessions like our car, computer, or our home. And yet our bodies and minds are our home. Perhaps the reason we don't value them more is we get them for free. We're born in them. By the time we realize the value, for many of us, it's very late. It's not too late. So be healthy. When we are healthy, it's easier to follow the second simple rule, which is be kind. The Ten Commandments tell us to honor our parents, which is fine. After that, they tell us not what to do, but what not to do, not to murder, steal, lie, commit adultery, or covet. What we need to do simply is to be kind. Treat each other, our friends and neighbors, better. Stop exploiting each other. It doesn't matter how much money we have or earn, what size home we live in, what kind of car we drive, how many academic degrees we may have accumulated, what accomplishments we may have achieved, what our position or title is. Nor does it matter what our gender, race, religion, age, appearance, national origin, sexual orientation, or political affiliation. What matters is whether or not we are kind to one another. The third simple rule is respect the environment. In every way, we're linked to the environment. Everything comes from the environment. If we destroy the environment, we destroy ourselves. In time, damaged environment and ecological systems will regenerate, but we'll be gone. Nature, which couldn't care less, will have eliminated us. Three rules, seven words. When we follow them, our lives change. As many of our lives change, our world changes. Be healthy, be kind, respect the environment. If you wish to astonish the whole world, tell them that, the simple truth. Now, if you wanted to continue about transformation and change and how we go about that, we can transition into that, Steve, unless you...
Well, I would love to just be with these very simple concepts. Be healthy, be kind, respect the environment. And the question in terms of integrating these is that... it seems like a lot of the institutions of our society seem to be about being unhealthy, treating people and the environment unkindly, disrespecting the web of life. And so many individuals who are awakening, there's millions if not billions of people who are awakening right now to, you've put it so well that I think a lot of people go, yeah, I can get behind that. Wow, that's really profound. And yet, the institutions that govern our daily lives and so on seem to be hell-bent on the opposite. So what is the transition right now from, first of all, awakening to this understanding and then to beginning to bring those principles into our individual lives and then necessarily our collective lives, because we are on a, you know, the crises are not going to allow us to continue in limbo forever.
Yeah, that's a complex question. I don't know if we have time to answer it. We can begin. You're really alluding to our competing sets of survival instincts and,
let's talk about that. I think that's an important point right now. Our competing sets of survival instincts, I think, will tell us a lot. Go ahead.
Well, be healthy, be kind, respect the environment. Now, it sounds simple enough, and why don't we do it? That's the question we're asking. Why don't we don't do it? Because we have competing sets of survival instincts that that produce, you know, opposing worldviews that accounts for the epic struggle that goes on daily for the evolution and survival of humanity. The first set of survival instincts is very normal. It's natural. It's organic. And it's disastrous. It's our short-term survival instincts. Like all creatures, we're programmed to survive for the short term. It generates behavior characterized by fear, greed, power, control, immediate gratification, self-centeredness, authoritarianism, and denial of inequality. It's a set of survival instincts that is literally destroying us. To compete with this, though, evolution gave us something else. It gave us large brains, and our large brains allow us to reflect on our behavior and to project to where our behavior's taken us. Where our behavior's taken us is not a pretty picture. We're like an airplane flying overhead with somebody on the wing popping rivets until finally the airplane crashes. It occurs to us that we don't want to survive for the short term. We want to survive for the long term. We want to sustain humanity and advance our civilization. the word sustainability has come into wide usage, the understanding that we must leave this planet as we found it or improve it, so those who follow us have the same opportunities that we have had. We understand that our behavior cannot be characterized by fear, greed, power, control, immediate gratification, self-centeredness, authoritarianism, denial of inequality, but has to be characterized by health in all of its dimensions, mental, physical, emotional health, by kindness toward each other and other nation states, by respect for our environment, our ecological systems, our biosphere. Bottom line is we live in a very narrow and fragile band in this solar system that allows life to exist at all. Now, each set of survival instincts, short-term and long-term, generate worldviews in the area of politics, business, social interaction, and religion. In the area of politics, this old way of thinking generates a politics that's adversarial, hostile, and belligerent. It's about the destruction of one's perceived opposition. Perceived opposition, whether the opposition is an individual or a nation state, it's about unilateralism and unjustified preemptive wars. The emerging way of thinking is non-adversarial. It's by finding the common ground and, more importantly, the realization we don't have the time, the resources, and the energy to fight with each other. We've got severe and complicated problems on this planet that must be addressed urgently in a cooperative and constructive manner. In the area of business, the old way of thinking is short-term gain. Maximize profits in the short term. Exploit people. Exploit the environment. The emerging way of thinking is long-term gain, sustainability, respect people, respect the environment, socially responsible business, a triple bottom line, people, planet, profit, and more importantly, the realization that life's a far more complex phenomenon than a race to see who can accumulate the most. In social interaction, the old way of thinking is we versus them, exclusivity, segregation. The emerging way of thinking is inclusiveness, integration, oneness, togetherness, assimilation. In religion, the old way of thinking is my truth and my tribe versus your truth and your tribe. It results in never-ending conflict and chaos, the absolute antithesis of peace. The emerging way of thinking is whatever your religion is, just be kind. And think intelligently about the origins of these ancient belief systems. And think intelligently about the origins of the phenomenon of religion itself. The old way of thinking is about separation, exclusivity, segregation, unilateralism. The emerging way of thinking is togetherness, unity, inclusiveness, integration, multilateralism. Many people are predisposed as a consequence of their life experiences and genetics to think and act in this old destructive way. It requires unlearning. What do we have to learn? We have to learn that we exist as a tiny fragment of an immensely larger interlocking whole in which all the parts are interconnected and depend upon each other for survival. Simply put, everything's connected to everything else. We exist not separately, but in communion with all their living things. Life's an interrelated, interdependent phenomenon. Everything's in relationship. The nature of the universe, the nature of life, it's the nature of the reality in which we exist. This reality has behavioral demands. They can be summarized in 7 words. Be healthy. Be kind. Respect the environment. These 7 words have the power to change life as we know it. The way we govern, the laws we enact, the way we do business, the products we create, the way we treat the environment, the way we treat our employees, the way we treat each other, the way we treat ourselves. Be healthy, be kind, respect the environment. Leaders must model that behavior. Teachers must teach it. And we must exhibit it if we're going to sustain humanity and advance our civilization. It requires entering into a completely new understanding of the reality in which we exist. The window of opportunity make the necessary and monumental shift in thinking is small compared to the large obstacles in our current belief systems that must be dissolved. Yet we must do this if we and all the other life forms on this jewel of the planet are going to survive. Be healthy, be kind, respect the environment. Go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say that you've really made an important point that religion is really has been traditionally associated with tribalism, and it preserves our identity in these smaller organizational systems called tribes. And now we have to bump up to a larger context that you've offered. And I know we're running out of time, so I want to make sure that we get the major points here. But I would say that, given that this is my first show of the new year, in the other interviews that I do with business people, et cetera, with politicians, we're going to be looking at measuring the actions and programs and processes against this very simple template, this very simple idea for how we are to be. Does it promote individual health? Does it promote kindness among our human selves? And does it respect the web of life so that we can sustain life on the planet? So there's lots and lots and lots more that we could say. If you want to sum up in perhaps a minute, what is it that people can do? How can people begin to – oops, I guess we can't even do that. I think this has given us a lot to think about. Joe Simonetta, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Steve. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And his book is 7 Words That Can Change the World. Go to my WikiPolitiki at Home Times Radio, and you'll find out more about how you can get this book. Steve Behrman saying goodbye for WikiPolitiki.